Yes, 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 yes. Welcome to the Tim McKernan Show, podcast episode number 2. I don't know if I'm going to keep a running tally. I don't know what I'm doing. I just know that the plan initially was long-form interviews. We started with Gary Pinkel, debuted that a couple of days ago. We have former Senator Jack Danforth coming up next week, Clay Travis coming up. But when we have things that are of topical interest, of substantial topical interest to the audience, I want to make sure we try and cover them as in-depth as possible. And so I like the urgency that sometimes people say we're going to have an emergency Facebook Live or an emergency Periscope. So joining me here in the studios to have an emergency podcast is the great Derek Gould of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch and also heard on 590 The Fan KFNS. Hello, Derek.
Hello. One of these things is not like the others. You got Pinkel, Danforth, Travis, and myself.
I think you're senatorial. Is that an adjective? You would be able to tell me if that's an adjective.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no,
it
definitely
is. Sweet.
Yeah.
Well, that's a nice one.
Yeah, it's a strong one. I think a little bit too strong in this. I would not compare myself to him or to that.
But I'm
that
telling you, when I said we're going to sit down, well, I said I was going to do a podcast. People said, oh, I'd love to hear you and Derek Gould talk. And I, really? All right. Well,
that's here we go.
Easy enough. Well, this is perfect.
Yeah.
Because
good
we're
timing.
Fresh off that the press conference, and a lot of people reacted to that because it had a different tone than those usual end of the year press conferences. Mm-hmm. My sense was there was some urgency, and there really usually hasn't been an undercurrent, at least, of urgency for those because they're usually coming off of either a postseason run or have a lot of equity with the fan base to the point that they can say, yeah, we might not have done this, but just recently we did that. And now I feel like there is a need for things to happen, not just this offseason, but in the 2018 season. So as you were sitting there yesterday, what stood out to you as you heard Mike Matheny, John Mozeliak, and Michael Gersh talk?
I think you're right on that urgency thing, and I think it goes back to the great rearrangement. I heard a tone that day when Mo stood up there and said that they were changing some of the staffs and letting Maloney go and adding Pop Warner to the group. I heard a sort of line being verbally drawn that I had never heard before. The front office had, whether it came to the development of players or the development of its manager or the development of a season, always shown a level of patience, like that we know what's best and that this is going to come around. That was a day where it was clear that it's like, no, now there are higher stakes and there's going to be an impatience with the roster. I mean, you could even probably trace it back to the Peralta move, which or the Broxton move, which honestly, a few years ago, we would have seen linger for a little while, right? But there was definitely a trace amount of urgency that then grew exponentially into culminating in that press conference. And I think the other strain that stood out to me was that everybody's ready to move on from 2017. There was really nothing about that team or that production or those standings or those results that anybody wanted to revisit. Learn from, maybe, but revisit, no. They didn't need to relive the highlights. Even the list of things that the team accomplished, which Mo likes to give in his opening statement, was really reduced. And when you look into it, two of the things that he mentioned was the production of Tommy Pham and the arrival of Paul DeJong, both of whom opened in Memphis. So in a lot of ways, 2017 was a celebration of Memphis in every way possible. And the Major League team was ready to move on from that.
That's
and
a key difference from 2016
agree.
To me is the emergence of players from Memphis.
Agree.
From a quote-unquote fan standpoint, talk show host, whatever I am, I have no idea. But the feeling I had watching this team, to me, was similar when I was watching the 2016 team.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like the fact that they kind of lingered in the wild card race in 2016, whereas this year they wound up lingering in both of them, I felt like it did a disservice to the organization's long-term and potentially short-term prospects because they didn't want to make sell moves because they appeared to be in it, while I would have to think deep down internally they knew that they really weren't a championship caliber ball club. And so for the second year in a row, minus unloading Mike Leake, they essentially stood pat during the season. Do you see those similarities? Do you disagree on that?
Boy, that's interesting. I'm not sure I I'm not sure I do. I think 2016 they lingered in the wild card race, partially because they never played to the performance that they thought. They were undermined by their defense. They had some other flaws, the fundamental flaws. They just were unrecognizable. But they had the talent to kind of overcome those, and they saw that in fits and starts and then really some bursts too. 2017, they were in it only because of the play of teams around them. And that to me is a really different equation. If the Cubs are underachieving and you're counting on them to stay that to be their new norm, when you know the talent they have, you know that, look, their pitching was thin. They didn't have the pitching depth, but that lineup was a titan, and they were going to win the games that they got well pitched. Oh, and they go and get Quintana. Yeah. So they're going to get more games well pitched. So, I think that's where that equation was off a little bit, is that they were in the division race and in the wild card race because the Rockies didn't put it away, because the Cubs didn't put it away, not because the Cardinals had better in them. The one thing that they clung to that made sense, and now when we look back at the outcome of yesterday's, or the big announcement of yesterday's meeting, might make people scratch their head, is that they had the pitching. Pitching can take you a lot of places, especially in October. And bullpenning, as we're seeing, we saw that in the wild card game when the Yankees and the Twins go immediately to their bullpens and just unleash the hounds in a one-game team or one-game playoff where they have the rosters that don't have the starters in it. You just throw one inning after one inning, or if a guy gets hot, go three like they did with Robertson. Pitching can solve a lot of things. And the Cardinals did feel, and rightly so, that they had the pitching to catch fire, and that would carry them if they could just get to October. I'm not carrying far in October, but if everybody sunk to their level and let them into the race, then come October, where everybody starts at zero, they did have the pitching to at least make it interesting. So naturally, the strength of the team, this pitching, if not pitching usage, I want to draw a line there, but the strength of the team in pitching is the one that gets addressed with the coaches being fired.
That's exactly
That's
exactly where I was going next. So the one thing that held on to any form of hope for Cardinal fans and perhaps the organization, the pitching, is the thing that is addressed immediately, and that is parting ways with Derek Liliquist.
Yeah.
Were you shocked by that? Because the cat, and sometimes I know he knows things and he can't say things, but on the Ryan Kelly Morning After, he said himself, unprodded, I was really surprised by that.
Yeah, and talking to Liliquist over the previous weekend, his contract was up, and he was aware of what that meant and what that could mean. It allows a team to pivot in another direction. We see that with players, whether it's going to be Sungwoon Oh or Matt Holliday, a contract's up, the team has an excuse to go in a different direction. But Lily spoke, about his want to return and his hope to return, and looking out at the arms that they had and what role he could play in it. And in some ways, I think he saw himself as a way to defend the talent as well as nurture the talent. Like, look, I mean, these are my guys. I want to stand and protect them and make sure that they get the attention and get the rest and get the use that they deserve. But in another way, he put himself maybe in a spot where the Cardinals want to go in a different direction, one that maybe would put Mike Matheny, the manager, in a position to take input from the pitching coach and then utilize it, not just take input from the pitching coach when it comes to decisions and filter it into his own decisions. I'm real eager to see how this plays out, because the description that Mo gave of what he wants in the next pitching coach, you notice it was Mo that gave the description of what he wants in the next pitching coach. When I asked Mike what he wants, he wanted communication and knowledge and an openness to take things forward. But what Mo wanted was very clear. And the best description that I've heard of it is that it's a pitching coordinator. Like you would have a defensive coordinator in football, or you would have a offensive coordinator in football, that this is a guy who's going to run plays. This is a guy who's going to call plays. Now, with the advice of the head coach, but it's going to run plays. And it's going to take data that is given to them from the front office and put on an iPad or put on the stack of cards that the Cardinals have, and that it's going to be, all right, here's a pathway to make these choices.
Well, it sounds like they're special kind of position to customize it to the manager.
Cubs have it. You know, I mean, the Cubs have the great mad genius, Joe Maddon, and yet, you know, their pitchers will credit some of their pitchers. Some of their pitchers are irritated by it, I'm sure. Some of the veteran guys, mainly because John Lackey's irritated by everything except for the fit of his cowboy boots. But, you know, they have a run prevention coordinator. They have a catching coach. And those guys put together hyper-detailed scouting reports. What pitch to throw to what guy, when, and where to throw it. Stuff. You know, that's the new age. I mean, that's where we, you know, we have so much data thrown at us, and it's even more increasingly public with the advent of StatCast. But, you know, basically what Lilliquist and really Dave Duncan, what Dave Duncan was able to do with his treasure troves of stuff where he would track where a guy hit what pitch and help that inform approaches down the road, or what pitches were called by what guys, or what suggestions were made to the catchers. We're all now they do it with, you know, the power of a computer, not the power of Dave Duncan. Mm-hmm. And that has led to a really, I'll use the word again, hyper-specialized approach to pitching. What the Cardinals want is somewhat that, but they also want to be aware that starters are going less and less. You know, it's really, you know, it used to be a given where you'd look for a guy who could give you 30 starts and 200 innings, and this was the kind of mode to contention, that innings mattered. We're now seeing that dial back to 180 is really good. And if a guy gives you 30 starts and 180, you know, or it barely gets there, mm-hmm. That's really good. That's averaging six innings, and that's a huge thing now. Yeah. You know, and you look then at who the Cardinals are going to turn to as far as youth. You know, are they going to get 150 innings, 175 innings from Luke Weaver? Are they going to get 120 innings from Alex Reyes? Where does Jack Flaherty? Will they get 100 innings, 120 innings in the majors from Jack Flaherty? What can they count on from Adam Wainwright? Is he a 170 inning guy? I mean, you start seeing them peel back, and you realize that leaves a lot of exposed innings that bullpen management now, or bullpen construction, is going to be invaluable. It's almost like, you know, that they have for years carried a guy, an extra reliever, because Mike wants that security, even though he has no intention of ever using him, but mm-hmm. he wants that security. Well, that guy now is no longer going to be under glass. He's going to be essential
right.
to what's going on. It's almost like the sixth starter is this floater who just sops up innings every, you know, three times every 6 days that the starters leave, you know, uncovered. And that's the wave of the future. And to handle all that, you have to have some data-driven choices. Someone who is open to that, and someone who is aware of that, and someone who the manager will go, yes, that sounds good. Let's do that.
Relative to other managers in baseball, how much of Mike Matheny's decisions are data-driven?
I wish I knew. That'd mm-hmm. be great. I don't know. I know that they're data-informed. Mm-hmm. I know that he has a high degree of data-informed decisions, because that's part of the evaluation that the front office does of his job.
As far as Matheny himself going into 2018, I feel like it's the first time, and I'd have to go back. I don't know. I guess there had to be a time. I don't even know if it's when you were covering the team. Maybe you could cite it, where I feel like we're going into a Cardinal season. Granted, it just ended a few days ago. Where you go, yeah, I could see the manager getting fired. Yeah. I don't recall thinking that. I mean, I'm certain it was going on in the La Russa era, but I don't know when realistically it would have taken place, because I doubt it was happening after 2008.
When did the banner fly over spring training? Was that 04?
Was it before 04?
Whatever the faction they called themselves, right?
Is that what that was called? I do remember that.
I think that was 04.
Okay, well, good timing. Maybe that another banner leads to another world championship.
There you go. Yeah. Somebody hire a plane. Yeah, make it happen.
But all they were doing was coming off of one non-playoff season, and they had won 83 games, if I'm not mistaken, in that 2003.
Sure, years of not going to the World Series. And not getting to the World Series.
96, 2000, 2001 NLDS, and then the 2002 NLCS.
And some of them ending rather poorly, you know, some of them ending Grady Little-like.
Which one stood out to you in that category?
Well, I mean, you had some injuries, you know, but they were the better team a couple times going in, you know.
I would say that with the both Mets, the Mets and right, the Giants.
And the Giants. Yeah. And the Giants stood out, but the Mets won too.
Absolutely.
You know, they were the better team going in. And so you had, I mean, it wasn't like Grady Little in the sense that it was leaving a guy linger too long.
Right.
But it was Grady Little in the sense that it was like, man, this is going to, if they're going to make sort of a one decision or a one game kind of choice on their manager, you know, these things are starting to stack up.
Right.
So you did have that. I joined the beat in 2004 after the banner had flown. But I was aware that it was possible that I might get a chance to cover baseball.
And for the record, for those who aren't familiar with it, it was a banner that flew over a spring training game, right?
And
what did it say?
Oh, boy.
Save our Cardinals.
Save our Cardinals. Fire Walton Tony.
Is that what it was?
Something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was long. Save our Cardinals. Yeah, it was along those lines.
Yeah. And they wanted La Russa and Walton.
Yeah, it was both.
Okay.
And the sense was, you know, the articulation of it, or sort of the read from the Cardinals' point of view, too. And then when you saw, I mean, that was also an interesting time because you saw what message boards, sort of the precursors to what we have on Twitter, you know, whatever. What were some of the things like email groups or chat groups? That's what I'm looking for. You know, all these names that we've kind of dusted over because we have better tech now, I'm struggling to think of, but you know, they had all these explanations of it, and some of it was just impatience. Look, mm-hmm. you know, you can reach for the brass ring and nick it with your fingernails so many times before you really ought to grab it. And if this group can't grab it, time to move on.
To look back on it now, of course, with the benefit of knowing what happened in 04, 05, and 06, mm-hmm. it seems ludicrous.
Right.
Now, who knows what's going to happen in 18, 19, and 20. But now I do feel like, I mean, again, coming again from a fan / talk show host perspective, I just haven't felt like these have been really good teams. I don't feel like the market is real, finds the product compelling.
That's the big part for me. Yeah, and you would be better. I mean, you probably would be better to address this than me, but I just get a distinct sense that this team, and the only way I've come up to describe it is that it captures the imagination of the fan base.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the 15 team was really good. It won 100 games. It won a division where another team won 98 and another team won 97. Right. And yet, was that team all that celebrated?
No.
It didn't feel
and
that
so
way.
So then I go back and I analyze it, and I wonder about this because I apply theories that might not be proper to. I remember sitting in the press box of Rams games when they were, you know, I mean, cocaine on turf. I mean, that's as good as it can get for a football product.
I have no idea what that's like.
I'm not saying I do either. I'm just saying it was an incredible high. And we as St. Louis football fans had gone from having nothing mm-hmm. to all of a sudden the greatest. And then I remember thinking to myself, thinking long term, whenever this wears off, what's it going to be like when you don't have Kurt Warner, Marshall Faulk, Isaac Bruce, Torrey Holt, Oz Hakim, and a damn good defense to boot? You're going to go from this, and then even if you have a competitive team, it's going to seem like it's terrible in relation. The other analogy I would draw is the Atlanta Braves. They had nothing, really, from 1982 all the way to 1991, and then they just had this absurd run that went on, really, for a couple of decades. But then even while they were winning division championships, they weren't winning World Series in the 2000s. Part of that, the Cardinals got them in 2000. And they had a bunch of empty seats. I remember being at the NLDS in 2000 when the Cardinals clinched it there, and it was just empty seats everywhere. It was game three of an NLDS. And the theory there was, first off, transient city, different than St. Louis, but then secondarily, that the fan base had gotten spoiled.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember our
apathy set in.
Yes, and I remember our cohort, the late, great Joe Strauss, saying, I'll be really intrigued to see what happens in this market, in this region, with this fan base, if and when the run starts to slow down.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, perhaps that is what has happened. Because I agree with you. Now, in 2015, I remember going to that postseason thinking, they won 100 games. But if I'm going to compare them to the 05 team, which won, did they win 100 on the nose? And the 04 team, which won 105?
That's right.
And then the 1985 team, which was a 100-win team, for my money, that 15 team, I don't put them in those in that category.
But they may have been as good as any of them because that was one of the best run prevention. But it wasn't. See, that's part of it. Maybe is that was one of the best run prevention teams of our generation. And then along the next year came the Cubs, who were just as good as run prevention. However, run prevention is not sexy.
Right.
You know, one of the executives with another team told me here recently, he goes, you have to look at it from this perspective, is the ability to save a run is worth the exact same as the ability to score a run mathematically, mm-hmm. right? However, try telling that to fans because right. you can't win a game -1-0.
Right.
Right. I mean, you know, do you want to see runs scored? You want to see a player who is energized? You want a moment to sit on the edge of your seat and go, yeah, man, this is the team that is going to do it. And maybe that's what's now you can't create that. But look, the Cubs have that. Anthony Rizzo comes to the plate and, you know, nuzzles up to the home plate and does whatever he does there. And, you know, people are on the edge of their seat. He's on the edge of home plate. They're on the edge of his seat. You know, Chris Bryant comes right. up. He's on the edge of, you know, he puts people on the edge of their seat. Even Javi Baez in the middle of the infield can create some electricity. So do the Cardinals have that? I mean, they haven't for a while, really. Right.
For a while, too.
Yeah.
I would go back before even a year where they won 100 games. It's a weird spot. Now, I could be wrong. This is not a data-driven opinion. This is just a feel for it. And then you combine that, and I think it is a feeling that's shared by a lot of people in the fan base, which doesn't necessarily make it right. You can have something that a lot of people think is true and polling properly, but not necessarily be factual. But in this case, I believe that feeling is there. And then you have two straight trade deadlines where you are lurking in races, mm-hmm. not because of like 04, where it's like, my God, we're great. Let's add to it with Larry Walker. It was, mm-hmm. oh, well, we're in the mix. And they didn't really do anything. And so there may be a feeling. A lot of the fan base isn't happy with Mike Matheny. A lot of the fan base isn't compelled by the product. And then feels like we're showing up to the tune of $3+ million. And we're not seeing the organization go out and try and bolster our chances at the trade deadline. Mm-hmm. And so I think when you have those combination of elements, I think it leads to a frustrated fan base.
I agree. And I mean, I'm glad you articulated it that way. And because of that, I kind of get this sense that, and it sings out, it resonates with the criticisms that I get. And also what I see is that there is a sense that the team is busy making business decisions and not busy making baseball decisions. And that can turn a fan base that is used to baseball and winning baseball and wanting baseball, that can turn a fan base against them mm-hmm. if they're not very articulate in why they're making these baseball decisions. I think a lot of times, and maybe this happened in the press conference, and maybe even happens in the coverage of the team when I write, when I try to explain, like, look, they're trying to make these value-based deals, eyes glaze over and go, come on, just get us some home runs. The eyes glaze over and go, enough about the margins and, you know, years of control. Just bring in a guy who sends shivers down our spine when he hits the ball. And I get that, and I understand that, that maybe that's the magic isn't there because the magic isn't in the transactions.
Yeah.
Everything is so calculated that there's no time for magic.
See,
because you think about it, Albert Pujols was magic.
Right.
All right? That was magic, not just with his production, but how he arrived. That was a scratch off to a luck. 13th round, you know, guy who really just, you know, had crazy ability, but also a fierce competitive aspect. Oh, and by the way, had a lot of things pour into him just at the right time. The anger of being passed over so many rounds, which, mind you, the Cardinals did 12 times too. So, you know, they can claim, oh, well, we took him. Yeah, well, passed over him 12 times. So the fact that Mark McGwire was there, the fact that you had Tony La Russa who bought into it, and just all these things that kind of gelled at the right time. Oh, and he already had the infrastructure of Roland and an Edmonds there
right.
for him not to have to be like the guy. So that was magic. And Carlos Beltran came as a free agent but brought a little magic with him. David Freese was magic, right?
Oh, I mean, that's as magical a storyline as you get.
And it was hindsight magic, but it was magic. You know, so I get the sense that when fans go, all right, we get it. We understand the spreadsheets. We understand why this is important. You know, we see why it's necessary for the team to not act like the Yankees of old. We get it. We understand why the Cubs will probably have a higher payroll for a long time. And don't discount the fact that it's the Cubs that are winning that plays into this. Mm-hmm. That's a huge part of this. But just once, just give magic. Just bring back a little magic.
So the thing is, what I feel like has become, it's been there for a while. It went away with a couple of world championships and then four straight NLCS appearances.
I remember those.
Remember those a few years ago? Is the DeWallet thing or Bill DeWitt's cheap? I feel like, and I'm really curious where you are on this. I feel like it's inaccurate. It's just inaccurate because the most prized free agent, unless I'm missing somebody, perhaps on the pitching side, going into the 2016-17 offseason was Dexter Fowler, which kind of confused me.
Justin Turner.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, but you would concede that Fowler was certainly
vaulted?
Yes. And they went out and got him, is my point. And they spent a lot of money to get him. And I felt like, you know, that was an overreaction to not getting who they wanted. And for the first time in a long time, and I actually would take it back to before you were on the beat and when you were on the Blues beat, but I was down at Busch Stadium all the time, granted, as a TV guy, I felt like the Tino Martinez signing was an overreaction to
that's fair.
McGuire retiring by fax and Martinez having a hell of an October with the Yankees a month beforehand, and we're just going to fix it really quickly. Now, granted, at the time, it was only a three-year deal. They wound up shipping him out for an underhanded pitcher, Evan Rust, I think, from the Tampa Bay Rays, and eating most of the contract. And fortunately, that really wasn't an albatross because they only had to eat, one of the years?
I think it was like $7 million compared to the leak.
To some of these things that you wind up seeing. But I feel like one of the reasons they've been able to maintain being at least competitive for this entire run, and I would include 07 and 08, granted, on the periphery, and 16 and 17, is because they haven't done these albatross-style deals. Granted, the economics are different now than when the era we're talking about. But I feel like if you just are in the mood of, you just got to do something, I thought Fowler fell into the category of just do something. Now, granted, I realize they needed a center fielder. That was the goal. They got a center fielder. They needed a leadoff guy. They got the lead. But now here we are just a year into the deal going, oh, God, A, how happy is he here? B, how happy are we that we got him? And C, is he even a center fielder or a leadoff guy anymore? Hell, that's C and D. And you have all these questions and you haven't even signed him for a year.
Yeah. I mean, he's a pretty good deal if he's going to hit 20 home runs and play left field. That's not a bad deal. I mean, if you think about it in those terms, like the Cardinals may have happened into a value proposition from their perspective if he's going to bat third or fourth.
But that's so that takes me back to the overall, and I guess I can go from a macro standpoint going back 7 years here. There have been a lot of happen to that have helped. They happen to lose out on Albert Pujols, thank God. Mm-hmm. They happen to lose out on take your pick on
Hayward
Hayward Price. You know, I don't know if people would say, it's a good thing they didn't get Price, but certainly I think people would say it on Hayward.
Yeah.
And they may have happened to wind up with a left fielder who hits 20 home runs and could be in the middle of the order, except the goal was to be the leadoff and center fielder. And so then it makes you go, well, where are things right now?
Let's apply that to another team we know really well, though, right? Okay, the Cubs happened to get lucky that Mark Appel was the 1-1 pick when the entire universe said, why aren't they taking Chris Bryant? Chris Bryant is a rarity in this game, an MVP caliber everyday player who can play the position third base that he's still playing. And he went second in the draft because Luno and his group outsmarted everybody, you know, because they were the only ones that were like, no, we'll take Mark Appel. So that guy, where's he? Where's he right now?
Where is he right now?
Yeah, he's in the minors with, Phillies, right? So, you know, they traded him. So the Cubs happened to get the best player in the draft with the second pick of the draft. You know, the Cubs traded a guy named Scott Feldman. Do you remember him?
Oh, yeah.
All right, okay.
Gave up the base hit to Lance Berkman in the 10th inning.
That's right. Okay, so they traded him to the Orioles, who were scrambling for pitching depth. And the Orioles had this pitcher who they couldn't figure out. His mechanics were weird.
He was from Farmington.
He was really resistant to change. Had really good stuff, but was wild all the time. Something that they traced back to his mechanics, which again, he was resistant to change. When he did, it didn't work. Put him in the deal, give him to the Cubs. That's Jake Arrieta. That deal doesn't happen. These Cubs don't exist. Mm-hmm. So they happened into Jake Arrieta. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, they won. I saw a number the other day. You know how many homegrown pitchers the Cubs had on their World Series roster last year?
I'm going to throw out one.
It was zero. But here's the better number. They won, 110 games or something along those lines, right? What they needed. No, they would have won more than that. But they won 100, whatever. Only one win all season long was attributed to a homegrown pitcher. Only one of more than 100 wins went to a homegrown pitcher. So they have, by design, decided, well, we are really strong on the position player side. We're going to have to buy pitching. But part of that is they're going to happen into guys. Mm-hmm. There were stories out of spring training about how they had four guys that they were going to throw at one of their problems, and they thought that maybe with this pitching coordinator stuff that we talked about earlier, mm-hmm. and maybe their catchers and maybe their offense and maybe all this and that and the point in their careers, they can make those guys work into a starters. Of the four that they tried to find, you know how many made their starters or made a difference in their rotation? Really none. Mike Montgomery comes as close as anybody.
Yeah.
And so they didn't happen into the starter that they needed. And what happened? There was a race. If they had happened into this guy, there would have never been a race all year. The Cubs would have blown away from the field. So, I mean, I get what you're saying, where the Cardinals happened into these guys, you know, Tommy Pham or whatever. But teams everywhere are doing it. The Brewers were an entire season of happening into things quicker than they expected.
Well, I guess I'm more in the Cardinals are fortunate that they happened to not do some things that they wanted to do.
Right.
And that's the line I'm taking.
Yeah.
Because where would they be if they did wind up signing Pools? Where would they be if they did sign Price? If they did sign Hayward? A lot of these things that the fan base, some, not many, I don't know what do you think the percentage was in the 2011 offseason on wanting to sign Pools of the fan base?
Oh, that's a guy.
I don't know. I was vehemently against it in 70-30 to sign him.
Yeah,
really?
Probably.
Wow. I would have gone 50-50. I don't know.
I think there was a lot of legacy talk, and I think legacy does move the needle.
Yeah.
I think we saw that with Yadier, that if it's going to be $5 million extra a year, the legacy is worth it. And, you know, there was a sense that the Cardinals are coming off of, there was a fever dream of a great World Series and keeping that team together. And, you know, Tony had already walked out the door and his legacy was complete. Let Albert leave when there's a statue outside to greet him. Yeah. Let's make that happen so that the day he leaves and plays his last game in baseball, he walks out the door and drives by a statue that's already in place.
Yeah.
I think that did motivate or move a lot of people. And I think that actually was on Bill DeWitt's mind.
Too. Yes, I do as well. I would agree with that. I'm sure you have more knowledge than I do on it, but I think we probably have a similar basis for our opinion on it. But along those lines, in the past, recent past, the reason why they were able to do what they did from 2000 through 2006 with that era of team was that players either came here or they wanted to come here,
right,
and then stayed.
Yeah.
For the first time in a while, we're hearing or knowing, depending on your perspective, of players who either don't want to be here or didn't want to come here or chose another organization over the Cardinals. What do you think the reason is for that, and how much will that factor into what the Cardinals try to do this offseason?
I think there are myriad reasons for that. I think one direction, I'll give you some reasons, and then I'll suggest a direction that we also go with this, because I think we're circling the drain of one issue, we're like, we got it corralled, and we're gonna catch the issue that really we need to wrestle the ground that defines where the Cardinals are right now. But first, on the periphery, that's a very podcasty NPR type tease. On the periphery.
I like this a lot.
I think that the Cardinals are not the most appealing team in their own division, which for a long time they were. I think the Cardinals used their history and their pocketbook to sway guys into taking less because of the known quantity of contending and competing and short trips and being in the Midwest and family and all that stuff. And all of that does not necessarily appeal to the new generation, which...
When you say short trips, you're talking about like not being in Seattle and having to fly to Miami.
Yeah, that's right. Not being in San Francisco and having all the red eye. These things, you know, they had a very modern clubhouse, something that the Cubs didn't have. You think back to when Prince Fielder was a free agent. And I had this little pet theory that, and some of it bared out, that that free agents within the division had very little interest in going to the Cubs because they had played at Wrigley. They knew what the facilities were like. They knew what day games were like. They had been through that so often because they'd been in the division that they, that was a knock against Wrigley. And it was, you know, the clubhouse was terrible there. Yeah. Well, now it's not. Now that's the destination place. I mean, even Hayward said it. I mean, and actually several people within the Cardinals organization said it. Look, it's there. They cannot, they, the Cubs could offer something the Cardinals never could, and that was appealing to a group of players. You know, the Cardinals couldn't say, hey, come win a championship for the first time in 100 years. The Cardinals could say, hey, come win another championship, which is a different sales pitch. Yeah. And they're players who are more appealing or found the Cubs more appealing. I think, you know, the other parts of this are managers. We see very different managers in the league. Enough to fit the different personalities of teams, or I'm sorry, of players. Some players are going to want a really business-like manager, a very players-first manager. Some players want to go, and if they're going to spend 162 days or, you know, more than that with spring training, 8 months with a guy, they're going to want, you know, a pal. You know, some want somebody closer in age to them. Some want the reputation that a guy has. Some people want a city that swirls around them with opportunity and not with protests. You know, I mean, just to be blunt. And
you think that factors in?
I think it does factor. And I think players have a lot of questions. I mean, I've been asked by players, what is it like there? You know, both good and bad. You know, they've asked me, like, well, what is it like? Like, can I go and take my family to breakfast or lunch, what will that be like? And I'm like, you know what? The fans here are going to be really respectful. He goes, oh, I won't have people tweeting that I'm here or taking photos there. I'm like, actually, no. In my history and my understanding with players, they keep their distance, and that can be appealing. Okay, well, what's the safety like around the ballpark? All right, well, let's have a discussion about that because, you know, there has been a shooting outside the ballpark. There has been questions about security around the ballpark. You cannot ignore that. And it depends on what they latch on to as to what they care about. And that brings us to the crux of what has changed in the last few years when it comes to both acquiring talent, both happening into talent, and both pitching the Cardinals. Every team in baseball now has such revenue that you're pretty much talking about being able to afford players. Yeah. The question is always the out years. How much are you willing to stomach when that player is older and less productive? That becomes the question. Every team now overvalues their prospects, meaning that they know exactly what to hold on to as far as control. They lock them up to deals. They commit to them. Every team now is unearthing diamonds in the roughs late in drafts or off the independent heap, or, you know, that another team slip through the waivers. Every team is doing that, and now they're doing it at a younger place. And an example of that would be Luis Perdomo, who the Cardinals left unprotected in the Rule 5 draft, and the Padres went, you know what? We're not trying to win this year. We got a spot on the roster. We think he might be something. We think he might be a starter for us. And lo and behold, Luis Perdomo would have helped the Cardinals this year as a starter. Luis Perdomo would certainly help the Cardinals next year as a starter. Luis Perdomo is the type of move the Cardinals used to make while other teams watched and wondered and said, how do they identify that? And that's a long way of saying that the game has caught up to the Cardinals. I've heard that so many times from so many different levels of other organizations that they saw the Cardinals were far ahead in developing pitching, identifying pitching, and holding on to their young talent, and also that they were really good at winning deals. You look at what they, when they traded Edmonds and what they got back for Edmonds. You look at when they then flipped Freeze, who came in the Edmonds deal, and what they got back for Freeze and Fernando Salas, who they were going to non-tender. The Angels could have had him for nothing, right? You look at those deals, and that's only just a few years ago, and teams go, what are they? How are they able to pull this off? The game caught up with the Cardinals. And some of the
Cardinals
teams,
being not on the forefront of the cutting edge, or is
well,
that
that's what
the
most
economics?
Said. Most well, it's big economics has allowed for that. Hedge fund management of teams has allowed for that. You see a lot more GMs funneling in to into the game in the last 4 years that watched the how the Cardinals built their dynasty, learned from it from afar, and then bring this business application to it. I mean, look, I mean, there's a reason why when Theo Epstein and Jed Hoyer took over the Cubs, they said, we want to create what the Cardinals have, because they had it. They had the blueprint. They may even have a subscription to the Post-Dispatch. Who knows? But they certainly knew about what the Cardinals were doing, could see it from afar, and could read, you know, the stories I did about what they were, how they were finding pitchers and using pitchers, and even right down to how they were identifying pitchers like a Seth Maness at AA for a role that he would have and excel in the majors, you know, things like that. I had a few years ago, I did a story about, you know, how they found these pitchers. And, you know, you always talk to scouts, and I talk to other GMs and everything like that. And this had never happened before, because a lot of times scouts will be like, hey, man, though, you know, I don't want my name on it and everything like that. But I was talking to a scout about what he sees, because he goes through all the minor leagues of the Cardinals and everything like that. And he says, you know what? Put my name on it. Put my name on it, because I want the Cardinals to know that I know what they're doing. And I want my team to know that this is what we should be doing. How about that? Put my name on it, he said. I mean, it wasn't anything like, you know, it wasn't anything controversial. It was just him describing what he had seen the Cardinals do with pitchers. And, you know, just a few
weeks. It was kind of a secret sauce for a period of time.
I guess. I mean, yeah, I guess it was. There's still some of it that is secret sauce. But, you know, I mean, I was talking with somebody just a few weeks ago, and he was saying, you know, he goes, you can see what the Cardinals did for so long. He goes, and now you see it in pieces everywhere. And he used that phrase, the game caught up with them.
So if the game has caught up with the Cardinals, both the game and the business of the game.
Right, that's what I mean. Yeah.
And I follow it, and it's a fascinating detail that I think a lot of people will be listening to and go, wow, I've never heard it put that way. If the playing field is level, if the Cardinals don't have these advantages that they used to have to be able to get the players that they got here and then wound up signing to long-term deals to lay these foundations for these runs, the way that John Mozeliak, Michael Gersh, and Mike Matheny spoke at the press conference to wrap up the 2017 season was one of almost certainty that they are going to go out and acquire a big bat.
Yeah.
Hell, it even got to the point that someone asked him about, well, do you need two? And he said, sure, two would be great, but let's just start with one. And then I look at the landscape, and sure, there are names that we throw out in our sports talk radio fantasy lands, but when it actually comes to the pragmatic application of getting a deal done, whether it be a trade, or I don't even know what the free agent situation would be realistically, and how are they going to be able to truly do that? And if so, who really, really would fit that description?
Well, there are myriad to varying degrees. I mean, it depends on how broad, to use their word, a bandwidth you want to go with. Like you could see, all right, Donaldson is a fit for a year, and then you wade into the very deep pool of free agents that that is ahead. However, that means two risks, right? One, or three, actually. One, that Donaldson produces like a gangbuster in the 1 year that you have him. Two, that you can get him at a rate that doesn't really limit your prospects for the out years. Because three, you can't guarantee that you're going to sign one of the big guys. If anything, the Cardinals are maybe learning that going out and getting a guy who's under contract or under control might be their better way, because their ability to woo free agents
is lessened than it was before. Their ability to get a guy and keep a guy is maybe lessened than it was before. So, you know, they want to keep that in mind. So that's one way that basically kicks the can down a year to a bigger discussion. Now, Donaldson may go gangbusters, may love it here and stay. You know, that's entirely possible. But so too is the reality that you need to brace for something else to happen and that you're taking a risk that it will. So then you look at a trade because of the guys who are under contract, or you look at an Upton or a Martinez who are free agents and can lure them here.
Regarding Upton, because I see him kind of getting thrown around, perhaps their opinion on Upton changed, like other opinions on players, you know, evolved, if you want to call it that. But a couple of years ago when Upton was a free agent, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of interest.
They had cursory interest. Part of that was the cost and the, you know, they thought that, that he was being paid more for his age than for his production, which in the end is what Hayward ran into as well. So, yeah, I mean, there was cursory interest in Upton. Some of that, too, remember, was could they pull off a trade and then sort of get a guy of their preference as opposed to whatever the free agency offered.
Right.
Their view on that's going to change too because of what you began this conversation with is urgency. Urgency changes all sorts of things. You know, Zach Duke goes and has Tommy John and all of a sudden Brett Cecil's a Cardinal. I mean, these are not unrelated
cause and
events.
Effect, of course. Yeah.
So
you mentioned Donaldson, you mentioned...
Well, then you have the free agents. And that's where the outfielders from the Marlins come in. And then the wild cards out there, like what's Pittsburgh going to do? Is McCutcheon all that appealing? What are the Padres going to do? Is Will Myers all that appealing? The free agents from Kansas City, Mike Moustakas and Eric Hosmer, where do they fit? And do they add more confusion to the roster than they solve with the positions that they play? You know, all these things kind of bake in there, and you just always come back to the three outfielders in Miami. And that tipping point, all that everybody wants is, well, what direction does Jeter and the group go? You know, Jeter moves into his office, and now they're in a spot where they own the team that has a $300 million promise, whatever is left on that deal. And they're on the hook for it. So what direction do they want to go to either rebuild, rethink that team, or divest themselves of some of their financial commitments so they can start getting a return on their purchase? All those things are in play. And if you had, you know, if you go back and maybe put like some blinders on to some of the comments made during the press conference and listen to the type of hitter that they're talking about and where that hitter comes from, it is entirely from a team that has one and wants to pivot in a very different direction. So that's where you have to start. And then the next level would be, and this is the harder level. It's harder for teams. It's even harder for reporters to get, is who has redundancy that, you know, a young player coming and an older player at the position that they might want to replace, and can you swing a deal for that player? Mm-hmm. So who has an abundance of outfielders, you know, where they want to bump aside an older outfielder? Who has a third baseman, for example, where maybe there's a younger player, cheaper player coming up just in the third year or fourth year of a contract with an older player just as he's about to make a lot of money? You know, could they move them aside?
Yeah.
That's a harder one to pull off.
What, Christian Yelich is going to be 26 at the start of the
2018
season. A very good ball player. The Stanton thing is the one that, of course, is, and I don't want to,
sure.
Because I think by calling it a bright, shiny object, it kind of pisses on it, which is not my intention to do so. Because I do believe that there are.
You can call him the Orion. How about that?
That is nice. You're having a big day with the words, some of which I understand, some of which I don't, but I do on that one, and I love it. The Orion operation.
Call him the Orion.
It's Giancarlo Stanton. On that one, I remember asking you that throughout the course of the season, and you just kind of go, yeah, it's just not happening, and there's so many reasons why it's not happening. That was in June, July. Is that where you are still regarding Stanton?
So a lot of. Do you want a yes or no answer? Or
I don't. I enjoy expounding. That's the beauty of the podcast is.
Okay, we I wanted to be sure before I expounded. So I think a lot of people have said, "Well, you've softened on your stance," and it's like, "No, I haven't."
Well, some factors have changed.
Yeah, months have gone by, and I think a lot of what I told you and what I said on the radio and what I, probably ticked Frank Cusimano off about on his radio show, because it's like, look, man, I don't know how many times to tell you. It's not, I think a lot of that bared out. I mean, he passed through waivers. Giancarlo Stanton was available to all 29 teams. All he had to do was take on his contract. Now, I mean, we don't know if the Marlins would have said, oh, yeah, whoa, take him, yeah, or if they would have pulled him back, but he passed through. So no one even made a claim. There was no general manager who raised his hand and said, if you give him to me for no prospects, I will take that player and his contract. That, to me, is a referendum on, A, what the business thinks of that contract and the player's out-year values, and, two, how confusing that contract is for the next team and how difficult that is to pull off, right? And that was the sole discussion. That was my entire argument. Is it's so difficult for a team to go, all right, the Marlins want a lot of prospects for this guy because he has insane amount of talent and would be a feared batter in the lineup. However, you don't know if you're giving up those prospects for 3 years. You don't know if you're giving up those prospects for $300 million commitment. You don't know if his health will last into mid-30s. You don't know what position he'll play in the final years of that contract when he's making $30-plus million and could be, what, 1/6 of your payroll at that point in time. You don't know all these things, and you're asked to then fork over a bunch of talent for that player. That, when you see deals that are made that include a lot of talent, it's because the team getting the player is getting a below market value for many years. Adam Eaton, Quintana, these are the examples, right? There were no questions about what that team was going to have to pay or what that team was getting. The Cubs could make that deal and know, we are getting a starting pitcher at below market value who's left-handed until 2020. Yeah. Now, one of those years he might miss because of injury. That's how pitching works. However, we know what we're getting. With Stanton, it's less so, right? You know what you're getting next year. You know what you're getting the year after that. But for the bulk of the contract, you don't know if he'll opt out or if you have to pay him. And if you have to pay him, then where's he playing? What do you count from him? Mm-hmm. So now, one way to look at the deal, and this is where things have changed because there's been time and because the entirety of baseball told the Marlins what they think of that contract. That ought to be a lesson to the Marlins. Okay, people think that this contract is not good for this guy. So to make a deal where we get any sort of talent, that team is going to want the Marlins to share in the financial risk of that deal. That's where it comes from. So you have to find that number because the Marlins signed him to that deal. So the team that gets him is going to say, look, we will trade this much talent for what we think he's worth, and you have to cover the rest of that money. So a team like the Cardinals will say, well, we think we're going to get $220 million worth of production from him over the next 7 years. We understand that the deal is 8, 9, whatever. All right, but we think we're going to get $220 million of production that we can put a price tag on, right, from this guy. We'll trade you to that amount for him if you give us the money for the rest. And that's how those kind of deals are described. And that's a very oversimplification, but that's how you have to think about it. And that's the complication of this. And that's really where I've always tried to explain it, is look, if somebody were to take him, just raise their hand and take on his contract, then I was wrong, Then, all right, and the Marlins were right. But that didn't happen. Mm-hmm. And baseball now has sent a message to the Marlins. If you want talent for him, you're going to have to share in the financial risk of it.
Now that Jeter is, and we saw the picture of him sitting at the desk in Miami now.
With like a garage door opener behind it.
Yeah, still evaluating what that was.
I think that's for the stadium roof.
Is that what it is? That's what controls the stadium roof there in Miami.
I think it clicks
Miami.
Twice to open,
now it all makes
once
sense.
To close.
But now that he's there, and now that the baseball knows who's in charge in Miami, which was different than 5 months ago.
Yeah.
Do you think he's a Marlin when we're all sitting there in Jupiter, Florida, with the Marlins and the Cardinals sharing campsites?
I think it's a given that one of those outfielders is not. I don't know which one. I'm not sure. I'm
which
not
one
sure
do you think
they
intrigues
know.
The Cardinals the most?
Oh, well, are we all things considered, or are they dreaming?
No, I'm in the all things considered. What's
then it's
what's realistic?
I mean, you're talking about a guy who's under control. Basically, the best way I can do it, and it just happened upon this kind of description earlier, is he's the Quintana of outfielders. Mm. So you go, the Cubs go, well, we have a pitching hole.
Right.
We can't develop pitching. We need to get somebody else's pitcher, and we need to get him who's on a team-friendly deal and a rising talent who's only going to get better. Let's get Quintana. And let's give up a lot to get him. Let's go get that guy. So the Quintana of outfield, because the Cardinals are in a spot where we can't develop this hitter that we need. We're never going to get a chance to draft a guy like that. And we'd love for him to be under control for a long time so we don't have to try to woo him and deal with free agency and hope that he likes the Cardinals and all this stuff. We just want control.
Yeah.
That's Yelich. So Yelich is the Quintana of hitting.
All the focus, of course, on hitting, but they also touched on the fact that, hey, got to do something about the ninth inning.
Yeah.
What do you think they're going to try to do there?
Throw arms at the problem.
Yeah.
And they got their eye on a closer from Japan, kind of an O-like guy. So do other teams. So it'll be a process. But the Cardinals know him well. They actually have a connection to him that may help them. We'll see how that plays out. He's a free agent. He doesn't take a posting fee, doesn't hit on their cap, so they're not limited in what they can sign him. He's just free and clear like O was. So, they'll look at him. They'll look at the abundance of relievers that are out there. I mean, look, man, there are some really good relievers who are free agents that if you wanted to, I mean, it'll be costly, but it wouldn't be unreasonable to go, all right, and go sign four of them and see who emerges as the closer. Go get Swarzak, that guy who just blistered them. The former White Sox pitcher was up in Milwaukee, and I know he just blew the game here in Busch that cost the Brewers their chance. But that guy was fearsome when he was when he had just come aboard in Milwaukee and got overused and taxed, and that happens to guys. That guy. And find a way to look at him. Smith, the reliever with Cleveland, who was in Toronto, right? Yeah, Toronto. He's going to be a free agent. Tony Watson, who you've seen a lot of with the Pirates, he's going to be a free agent. Greg Holland and Wade Davis are also going to be free agents. Greg Holland, here's the lesson here. Greg Holland, had surgery, but signed a deal where he got this year and got paid based on what he performed. But he also had an option for next year. That option was $10 million team option unless he finished 30 games. If he finished 30 games, then it became a $15 million player option. All right? He finished 30 games by July?
Yeah,
because he was healthy and power and he proved it and everything like that. So now he gets to go, all right, well, I'll take $15 million. No, I don't think so. And the Rockies have to go, okay, well, will you take $18.1 million for a qualifying offer? And he can go, no, I don't think so. And he'll be like, bathing in riches as a closer.
Oh,
you know, so what a deal for him.
Yeah.
I mean, that's great. That is a very slick way to come back from an injury. When all right, I got a chance to prove myself, he goes out on the field and does it and then has protections within his contract that he can cash in. That's pretty smart.
Do you think Wade Davis is in any way in play for the Cardinals?
I think the Cardinals have had like a gluten allergy to paying market price for closers. They haven't done it since Izzy.
Yeah.
You know, that was the last time.
That's what I was thinking of as you were saying it.
I mean, how many years ago?
Dave Veers era.
Yeah, we were, you know, you and I were in our 20s.
That's right.
The last time.
That's right.
You know?
I was still taking the Propecia at the time.
Were you?
Yeah, I was. And then I shut it down, and now it's a whole mess. It's an absolute whole thing.
Really?
Yeah. It's a whole thing.
I didn't know.
Yeah. No, that's the next podcast when you come in. We'll talk about my Propecia use.
How young did you start that?
My first live shot at KOMU, January of 1998. Oh. The night I got my Propecia prescription was my first live shot at KOMU.
So it was TV driven.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Interesting.
Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm super insecure, but it was TV driven.
That's a whole element. Like, here, we both went to the Mizzou J School,
right? That's right.
So did you, because you were on the TV side at the same time as my
which
wife,
of course is a much, much higher level, of course, is the television
absolutely.
Side.
No. We saw.
I mean, that's the beacon of journalism.
No, I mean, when Rolling Stone, when we were students and Rolling Stone descended on us to do a story about the state of journalism and teaching, right? I mean, they went to the TV
absolutely.
Side.
Absolutely.
Yeah, they didn't hang
hey,
up with
who's the asshat doing sports on the weekend? We want to talk to him.
They didn't do any of the scruffy hangout at the Missourian. I don't remember them biking along with me to do my agate shift. I don't remember that. Honest question. Was part of the schooling there how you looked on camera?
It probably shouldn't have been, but there was a teacher there. I've said this on the radio, so I'm not speaking out of school. There was a teacher there, and I always thought it was good. It probably wouldn't go down now when there was a woman who was a little heavy.
Yeah.
He would tell her, she needs to lose weight, not because we're, you know.
Would you do the same for men, though? Like, was the. Would
I just remember
talk to
the
you about, like,
story
hey,
about
man,
telling
hair,
a woman
you
that.
Need to.
But on the hair thing, I just knew it. I just knew the program. And when I did get a job in New York in 2007, Kurt Gowdy Jr., the son of the Hall of Fame broadcasters who hired me, and he told my agent, he said, oh, could you have him grow out his hair? As if this is like a choice.
Yeah.
You know? And I'm like, this is kind of what we got. I can grow it out. I might be growing it out right now. Nothing is coming out. This is where we are.
That's fact.
But I stopped taking the Propecia in 2006, and now it's a whole thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. Like, one of the things, I go back to Mizzou to talk to them. And
you should tell them, make sure you're taking your Propecia. That's
no,
what you
I
tell
will.
The kids.
I will. No, but I don't talk to the TV folks, I don't think. I tend to talk to whatever their Convergence or the print folks. But I do kind of think, like, all right, one of the things I can do, and actually I recently spoke to, like, a class at Pepperdine, and one of the things they wanted me to talk about was the hours.
That's a good thing to tell people,
you know. And it's so rewarding
because you're never really off,
right? And not anymore. And it was really one of the there are two things that have been two conversations I've had that have been really rewarding with students that I think, man, if somebody had come to my class, this would have. And not just would have helped me, it would have given me such a head start on preparing for things. But I had to learn it from being around other reporters and stuff, but it would have been great to know this at 2021. And I was in the class, and one of the students in the back raised her hand and said, can I have your job and a family?
Poignant.
Yeah.
Powerful.
It was really powerful. And she's like, I really want this job. This means a lot to me. I'm not sure I want to cover baseball, but I want to do this job, and I want to do what you're doing, and I want to cover sports. Can I do that and have a family? And it was a great conversation. And then the other one was about sources and what is taught about how to use unnamed sources and anonymous sources, and what is the reality of using unnamed sources. And that one got heated.
You and the students?
Between me and the professor.
Oh, really?
We're good. So, I mean, he did not in like
anger. No, I'm just curious what the perspective
was. But in like
going
back and forth. And, and it was those two things. And that's why I asked about that. Because, I mean, if on your side of the aisle there at J School, they took a moment to tell you about like the real world visual medium, which I'm learning, like, you know, here for your podcast here. I think people know this though, but like when I do MLB Network, I wear a headset, right? I'll either wear the Han Solo headset or the Janet Jackson headset. And I actually, actually have my own Janet Jackson headset. It's because I can't hold a mic, in HD.
You can't hold a mic in HD?
A microphone in HD.
And the reason is?
Because I shake.
And what's the?
Like, just I have tremors.
Is the essential tremors,
yeah,
that was called?
Yeah. So
it doesn't affect you. It's not a. It's
no,
not a,
it's I
just,
mean,
it's just something that.
It's just something that, like, if I'm not paying attention to stop, you know, like, or doing something where it naturally stops.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So if I'm holding a microphone.
That makes all the sense.
So
in the world.
Before HD, no one ever noticed.
Really? I didn't know that there was an HD difference.
Oh, yeah. Huh. You can see the little. Because
really?
You,
because the little logo goes back and forth like that?
Yeah.
Wow.
So, yeah. So that's why I hold the. Or that's why I have the headset. I mean, it's not. It is what it is, right?
It's good inside baseball.
But that would be so helpful. You know,
absolutely.
I mean, I had people pull me aside and give me tips as to, hey, look, you know, back before the HD and the headset stuff was like, here, let's try to work through tips on to how to keep that thing still. You know, you use it, hold it with two hands. No, it made it worse.
Yeah, you know? There's nothing you can do, right? I mean, it's just the way that it is.
Oh, no, there were tricks that I, Dan McLaughlin gave me some great tricks.
Really?
Through the years, but HD has been my undoing.
How about that? Well, the headset's fine. I didn't even notice, and I see you on MLB.
Headset's fine. I don't mind it.
Yeah.
It makes me feel like I'm, you know, the co-pilot of the Millennium Falcon. Sometime on that show, I'm going to say, don't get cocky, kid. You watch. I'm going to say it.
Hey, tribute.
Yeah,
great,
no, it's going to be illusion.
Solo.
Yeah, I'm going to say it.
Well, I have no idea how we got on the topic of Propecia and your headset, but I'm glad we did.
No, because I was wondering about like the real world stuff.
That's what I always say. They need to tell, and I would be happy to go back down there. When I interviewed Coach Pinkel, I was down there. I was like, oh, maybe I'll stop by and see everybody at KOMU. And I feel like if I told them some things, it would probably chase them all out of the business. But the one thing they never told us about that they should have told us about was the revenue element, like advertising revenue. Because I'm like, oh, sweet, I'm winning Emmys. I'm winning Merle Awards. I'm going to make a bunch of money. Well, it's 15 years ago, and obviously it's paid off huge.
I have zero Emmys.
Well, why would you have an Emmy?
I don't know.
I have no.
My wife has two. I have none.
My point is, when I went into KMOV for my contract being up, they're like, that's nice. You're 26-year-old. You're working your hometown and you're doing radio. We know you're not leaving. Here's your 3% raise. Take it or leave it. Oh. I'm like, well, I won the best sportscaster, Emmy and Amuro. 3% raise. Take it or leave it. I'm like, oh, my God, this is trouble.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
But because it all gets back down to the advertising revenue and the bottom line, and I meant nothing to their bottom line.
Right.
And that's what I would tell the young tykes who are 19, 20, 21, 22
Absolutely.
Looking to get into this, because that is unfortunately reality, no matter how good your show is, how good of an anchor you are, how good of a writer you are, whatever.
Yeah.
If you don't have dollars attached to it, it doesn't matter. All right, I've already kept you longer than I planned to do, although I've enjoyed the hell out of it. Let me do a couple quick hits on this thing.
Sure.
The Cat was saying this morning that he thinks that the Cardinals will sign a starter. Simple as
yes.
You think so as well?
I think they will probably find a depth guy.
Lance Lynn.
Probably not Lance Lynn.
Okay.
But it may be, I mean, the starter could have name recognition.
And
the starter pool is not very strong, but it's deep, and they could pull off a Kyle Loesch. Remember when they
first got
Kyle Loesch,
absolutely.
Kind of thing,
yeah.
Where he lingered out there, and they were able to get kind of the deal to get a guy who would give them 170, 180 innings. It's that type of thing.
And as far
might not be 1 year deal, but that kind of
a closer goes. You don't think it's going to be in the Holland Davis category? It's going to be
I think they're going to throw arms at the situation.
And if you had to wager on who this magical bat is going to be, you would look to South Florida.
If one that keeps coming up.
You're not saying I know it's going to be this or that. You're just saying there's three choices down there, and therefore math is in my favor.
That and...
And the circumstances.
And the circumstances and the Cardinals' interest and, you know, what I've heard since before spring is Toronto, Miami.
Yeah.
One of these teams is going to take a turn. And that bat that the Cardinals want, that they think is transformative, they can make a play on. They don't know because it takes two to tango. They aren't quite there yet. But one of those teams, they want to be on the doorstep for when that team makes its choice.
And I didn't ask this of Gary Pinkel. I realize you're not running the football program, but I regret it and I'll always regret it. The Missouri football uniforms have confused me. They say it's for recruiting, even though they're not really recruiting anybody successfully in state. So I'm starting to question that whole thing. But the red hats the Cardinals wear on the road, it has really become a cause for me and Doug. But it's the one thing that Doug Vaughn and I reach across the aisle and we agree on, the red hats on the road. And you have said, when the Cardinals made that switch, they actually did a poll, and the poll favored the blue hats, but then they still stuck with the red hats. And I know they wear the blue ones when they're playing a team that wears red
hats. That was the compromise.
Right. Anything going on with that? I know because Bill DeWitt III actually does pay close attention to the uniforms, and they're great outside of the red hats. Remind me of like the Greg Jeffries era, even though I don't think he was around. I think they were wearing blue hats by the time he got here. But that's what it makes me think of early 1990s Cardinal baseball.
Yeah, he's going a little bit deeper into the past and wants.
But Musial wore a blue hat.
He did for an entire season. Yeah, I mean, that wasn't a road hat. That was like the hat.
The hat.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, his view is, you know, the red hats are what the. I mean, let's. I'm going to oversimplify it, but there's got to be an element to it. Look, they're playing the Cubs, right? This rivalry has never been at. This is peak rivalry.
Better than now. Dusty Baker and Tony La Russa screaming at each other in 2003 the great Jeff Fassero on the mound.
That's a flashpoint, but this is peak rivalry because this is real. And I think there's an element there of when you play the Cubs, let them have the blue hats. Cardinals have the red hats. That's the team colors. That's what they're known for.
I've never heard this theory before.
That's my.
Is this a theory or is this
my little pet theory? That's my little pet theory.
I hate this theory because that means we're stuck with this.
Well, I think you're stuck with it. I'm pretty sure you're stuck with it. Considering the calisthenics they went in, or the calisthenics or contortions, the contortions they went into to just allow for the blue hats. But I think I know from talking to Bill DeWitt III that he wants to be, you know, aware and respectful of the history and true to the origins of the uniform, even when they introduce something new. And he wants that, you know, the history to be reflected in how they choose. They do not want to get to a point where they have 17 different choices.
Like with the Diamondbacks.
They don't want to get to that. So they want to come up with a tried and true rule. But they also wanted to have the red hats back on the road. That was something that he really said. He said, that's how it was. That's how it should be now. That's the Cardinals wear red. I have heard that from him.
Nah. All right. Fair enough. Essentially, the first hour of this was just me wanting to get to uniform talk. I had to act like I had interest in all these other things so I could get to, hey, what's going on with the hats? That's essentially what the whole podcast has been about, and now I got it.
Yeah.
Sea Monster will put it as the lead.
Is this going to be edited?
We could.
Oh, I can't wait to hear.
We're putting this thing up right away. Like I said, Derek, this is an emergency. That's what we do, an emergency podcast.
This is a pop-up podcast.
I don't know if I'll ever get to a point where like something happens in a game and I go down to my basement and say, okay, we got to have an emergency Facebook Live. Maybe I will. Maybe. Mary Nickel does it with his WWE stuff, and I see he's killing it. So I do need to follow that. He didn't even go to the journalism school.
Right. See, real world application.
Exactly.
Facebook. Had they taught me about Facebook Live at Mizzou in the 90s, man, I would have been really sad.
Things would have been different. I would have stayed with the Propecia.
No.
Derek, thanks so much for doing this. I enjoyed the hell out of it.
Yeah, thanks.
And I certainly hope the Cardinal fans have enjoyed hearing your perspective on so many different topics here for the state of the Cardinals as we go into the 2017-2018 off season. So along those lines here with the Tim McKernan Show, like I said, it'll be long form interviews. Who knows what the hell will wind up popping up over the course of time. Gary Pinkle was our first one. If you missed that, I would recommend that. About 90 minutes with Coach Pinkle. And coming up next week, Senator Jack Danforth. Also, I'll be sitting down with Clay Travis live here in the studios in addition. And Derek Gould, kind enough to sit in here for episode 2 of the Tim McKernan Show. You can subscribe on iTunes. If you subscribe to the TMA feed or listen on InsideSTL.com. For the Sea Monster, for Derek Gould, I'm Tim McKernan. This has been the Tim McKernan Show.